Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of March. The Pew Research Center has done an analysis of changes in the nation's eligible voting population, and they found that this year will be the country's most racially and ethnically diverse ever. Nearly one in three eligible voters on Election Day, 31%, will be Hispanic, Black, Asian, or another racial or ethnic minority, and that's up from 29% in 2012. There's been a strong growth among Hispanic eligible voters, in particular those U.S. born youth. When it comes to U.S. Electorate being more diverse, the analysis says there is a caveat. The relatively low voter turnout rates among Hispanics and Asians, 64% in 2012 presidential election, for non-Hispanic white eligible voters, 67% of Black eligible voters. Voter turnout rate was 48% among Hispanics and 47% among Asians. And you have seen the piece in today's New York Times titled "Liberal Donors to Fund Drive to Spur Latino Vote." The billionaire George Soros and other liberal donors will bankroll a new $15 million campaign to mobilize Latinos and other immigrants this fall. As people have said on this program before, it may be one of those years where we're beginning to see Latina vote more reliably Democratic, and it may keep the Republicans from the White House for some time to come. We're going to be talking about the minority vote in this particular hour of our show today. We have two guests with us, Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics, Advisory Committee, Latin American and Latina Studies at Occidental University. She is co-editor of the book, The Impact of Gender Quotas, and she's done extensive research, travel, and speaking in Latin America and also in Europe. Also joining us is Charles Ellison, a veteran political strategist, contributing editor at The Root. He is a Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune, a frequent contributor to The Hill, and host of The Ellison Report, a weekly public affairs magazine that is broadcast and podcast on WEAA FM in Baltimore. He's written some interesting pieces, one titled "Stop Treating Black People Like a One-Issue Voting Pony." We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at @KDunn Show. Professor Jennifer Piscopo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Delighted to speak with you today.
Yeah, great to have you here. Charles Ellison, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, pleasure. Our pleasure. When you hear this overall number, and evidently this percentage is going to be going up 2 points every year or so in this country, that 31% of voters will be Hispanic, Black, Asian, or another racial or ethnic minority, what does that mean to you?
I can go ahead and let
all right, Charles. No, go ahead, Charles.
Sorry. So on its face, it's very positive. It's a very positive development because we're seeing these rapid demographic changes take place. And so, you know, that definitely, as we're seeing the growth of a population of color, which will be the majority population in the next, like, 20, 30 years. So naturally, you're going to see increases in terms of voter registration for Black, Latino, Asian voters. Also, don't count out Black migrants. Migrants from the Black diaspora, so to speak, from places in Africa and the Caribbean and elsewhere, that actually will account for a larger slice of the Black population as a whole, and they're very active and very vocal politically, particularly in key urban areas, right? But, you know, so on its face, it looks very positive, but the challenges come with, once again, and you just said it in the intro, Kathleen, in terms of the low voter turnout. So we have these turnout issues. So we did see Black voters participate and turn out very strong in 2012.
Yes.
In fact, the participation rates were higher than whites in 2012. With Latinos, you're still seeing, you know, they're not completely there yet like they could be in terms of, like, that full voter political maturity. But, you know, they're getting there and they're growing in numbers. It's just turnout is a real challenge. And so there are a lot of strategists, particularly on the Democratic side, who I talk to all the time, who are very worried about black turnout in 2016 because they don't feel mobilized or energized enough. Some people are also worried about Latino voter turnout as well, particularly amongst young people. So, you know, there's all this talk about millennials voting, but then millennials, especially during primaries, just don't turn out, which is a challenge for Senator Bernie Sanders. So the other last thing, too, real quick, is then there's the reflex, the reaction from the white electorate, from a white electorate, you know, particularly on the conservative Republican side, that gets very anxious and very nervous about these demographic changes because suddenly they're becoming the minority. And so that's kind of, you know, that's where we're seeing a lot of these racial dog whistle politics coming into play, particularly during this election cycle. And that's why they seem more pronounced, because there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. It's what a colleague of mine calls white electoral fragility. And so we're seeing a lot of that happening as well. So that kind of reaction we're going to see over the next several election cycles, particularly during the presidential election cycles. And that doesn't bode too well for political discourse in general.
Mm-hmm. And your response overall to these numbers, Professor Piscopo?
I would agree the overall trend is extremely positive, and the underlying trends are, of course, worrisome, which Charles already mentioned. We have low voter turnout, particularly low voter turnout among millennials. If we look particularly to Latino voters, we see that Latino millennials turn out less compared both to other demographic groups within Latinos and less compared to other demographic groups within millennials, so lower Latino turnout, lower millennial Latino turnout compared to white and black millennials. I'd also mention, if we think about presidential elections, which we are, it's important to look at where is the growth in the Latino electorate concentrated. And so although we see an overall growth in the Latino electorate when we compare 2012 to 2016, at the state level, the numbers really have not moved that much. So if we were to look at where are Latinos concentrated, they're still concentrated in states that we think already trend Democratic, so Florida, California, and New York. And if we look at swing states, the only swing states with high levels of Latino voters would be Florida, Nevada, Colorado. The rest of your swing states, Latinos still make up less than 5% of the population. So if we really think about where to drive Latino turnout in a way that matters for presidential politics, normatively, of course, it's important that all people vote, and especially all structurally marginalized groups, including Latinos. But where we might think about where will it really matter for Latino turnout moving the election one way or another, it's actually very few states, even with a growing diverse electorate, where we think the non-white turnout could still really impact the result.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Robinson had an interesting piece today or yesterday asking the question, will a Latino wall off Donald Trump? He writes, Donald Trump's favorite scapegoats could end up having the satisfaction of blocking him from the White House. Couple questions. A, do you believe that's true? Let's start with you, Jennifer. And B, why is it when the Republicans, I remember doing shows when the Republicans lost 4 years ago, and there was a very deep analysis of how to attract particularly Latino vote, because Mitt Romney lost that vote, a much greater percentage, fewer Latinos voted for him that voted, say, for George W. Bush. Somehow, what they were analyzing some years ago after that loss has not happened now, with the front runner being Donald Trump. What do you make of what Robinson said and the Republican soul searching?
I think first to speak to the question about, you know, is Trump scapegoating of Latinos going to be a unifying factor among Latino voters? And I think to a certain extent that's true. When we look at the numbers for Latino voters and we break Latino voters up into their distinct groups, you know, generational status, English dominant versus Spanish dominant, we see a lot of variance in support for Republicans versus Democrats. However, on immigration, we tend to see a unification of diverse groups of Latino voters towards more favorable, open immigration policies. And one way to think about that is that immigration is a cross-cutting issue that affects all different groups of Latinos. Similarly, I was looking at some data from Latino Decisions in 2014, and 67% of Latinos in a national survey know someone who is undocumented. And half of those 67% of Latinos said that undocumented person is a family member. So when someone like Donald Trump takes not just a strong stand on immigration, but phrases his stance on immigration in a way that's heavily racialized and heavily offensive towards immigrants, and especially undocumented immigrants, that hits Latino voters as a group, even if they're internally diverse. So I definitely think there is a sense in which the mobilization among Latino voters against Trump is very real and could be very, very deathly for the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about other issues of concern to that voting bloc in a moment. Charles, you have written some very interesting things about candidates treating African Americans like a one-issue voting pony. What is that issue?
Right. You know, so what you've seen in terms of the language, particularly in the Democratic primary, is you've seen a lot of focus on, like, for example, criminal justice issues. And so, you know, Bernie Sanders especially was very pronounced, had this problem in his stump speeches where, you know, he didn't mention black or Latino voters until he started touching on prison reform or criminal justice issues. So that's one. Also, you know, just sort of this perception that right now the black electorate is only concerned about Black Lives Matter or concerned about police reform, police brutality issues, because that's the headline of the month. And the problem there is that black voters, particularly when you look at polling data, are concerned about a wide array of issues, and they're very savvy, very knowledgeable about and very concerned about issues such as jobs, the economy, health care. Social Security especially ranks very high when you look at some polling data when you start looking at what the black what issue the black population is concerned about, and that's because black senior voters, particularly black voters who are 50 years of age or older, are have very high participation rates during these elections, especially during primaries. No one pays attention to those other issues, and so as a result, during debates, that seems to be the only conversation that's taking place. Is on these kind of headline, high-level, big-topic issues that also trend well on social media. And so there's the perception that black voters aren't that savvy, that they're not that intelligent, that they're not really kind of discerning between all these other various issues. And so it's just that they're just concerned about prison reform and police reform. Also, a kind of, in a way, sort of subtly perpetuates stereotypes about black people in general, that the majority of black people are incarcerated or that they're in jail, or that the majority of black people have all sorts of encounters, that all black people just have constant friction and encounters with police. So, you know, not only is it not covering issues like education, for example, many black voters very concerned about the state of public schools. You know, there was a poll that just came out recently, YouGov Pathways put out, which showed that, you know, that captured a huge chunk of black and Latino parents who over three quarters of them felt that the high school dropout rate is actually at 31% when officially it's at 6%. So, you know, the political discourse isn't capturing all of that. And so, you know, it's not fleshing that all out in the same way that it does for other demographics, especially white voters.
Mm-hmm. What was interesting, and I'm wondering if this was part and how big a part of his win in Michigan, Bernie Sanders, of course, surprised everybody, probably himself as well, with his win in Michigan, his best performance with black voters so far this year. And from what I've understood, he really concentrated heavily on ads and discussions in Michigan on the home foreclosure crisis, which has hit the African-American community particularly hard.
Right, right. Exactly. And so that's where he started. You started to see this pivot, especially as he went into a state, a Rust Belt state like Michigan, that's been hit hard by the foreclosure crisis, the recession, that's been also hit hard with changes such as over the years, with the introduction of policies such as NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and also the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm. Other trade deals where, you know, not only do you have blue-collar white working class voters noticing or concerned about those issues, but you also have black voters as well, because between the recession and trade deals, there is a perception that those are responsible for destroying or obliterating a quarter of the black middle class over the past 10 years. So, you know, people are, and hence you have foreclosures and other issues as well. So that he started to strike, you know, sort of a certain tone and hit a stride with the black vote, even though he didn't get the majority of the black vote in Michigan, but he hit enough stride where he was able to push it off. Now, that said, the black vote didn't turn out like it should have, or like it would have, say, if President Barack Obama was in the primary the other night. And so in Michigan, I mean, there was like really low voter turnout in big urban pockets like Detroit, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and still it went Hillary Clinton's way as far as the black vote. And as far as Hillary Clinton, she has to make that balance now between, yeah, you want to talk up black voters, you want them to vote for you, but at the same time, you got to also worry about white blue-collar voters and making sure they turn out as well for you. So, you know, it's a real it's very delicate balancing act that any candidate has to play, especially on the Democratic side when you have this diverse multicultural coalition. You have to be very careful. You don't want to alienate
right.
white voters that you might need to kind of offset your competition.
And Professor Piscopo, the Latino-Latina vote, do you think that it is being treated as a one-issue group that it's just immigration and nothing else? And is that really the case, that it is immigration?
I think it is certainly treated as if it was immigration, again, because we see this unifying force when immigration is talked about among Latinos. But I do think Latinos resemble other groups of voters when you take immigration off the table. So when we look at polling data that asks Latinos what is the most important issue to them in the election, and there's kind of a fixed list rather than, you know, name the first thing that comes to your head, they choose the economy and they choose education. So that makes them look very similar to black voters. It actually makes them look very similar to white voters. When those polls have been done in earlier presidential elections and things like national security and terrorism have been on that list, then those items also become ranked a lot higher. Does that mean that they have the same way of wanting to hear the economy or education talked about as perhaps white, black, or other demographic groups of voters? That's not clear, but we definitely do see that there are other policy issues that are really important to Latinos that can resonate with them, and again, education and economy being central there.
We welcome phone calls from our audience, our politically savvy audience. We are responding this hour to a really interesting Pew Research Center study that looks at what will be increasingly minority voting in this country, because we're becoming a more minority population with minority majority in the not too distant future. Since 2012, whites have had the least growth in eligible voters, and now the electorate this year will be the country's most racially and ethnically diverse in all times, with one in three eligible voters on election day, that's 31%, a little less than that, Hispanic, black, Asian, or another racial or ethnic minority. What does it mean for Republicans, particularly on the issue of immigration, particularly the way that the front runner has dealt with the issue of immigration? Will that drive many Latino-Latina voters to the polls? Now they're going to be funded big get-out-the-vote campaign from some liberal Democratic billionaires, millionaires, multimillionaires, multibillionaires. And we're looking at the African-American vote, too, and trying to understand more fully why it is that it's going very heavily for Hillary Clinton. If Bernie Sanders' message changed somewhat in Michigan so that he was appealing to more minority voters, and whether or not politicians are treating both communities as sort of one issue voters, that it's, you know, the issue of police relationships, about guns, about black people who are worried about law enforcement. We need to go way beyond that. If it's beyond incarceration, that we're painting people in a negative light, when a lot of people who are minorities and are concerned about education, are concerned about the economy, are concerned about a number of other issues. So, well, we'd love to have you join us. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please give us your comments, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics, Latin American and Latino-Latina Studies at Occidental University. Charles Ellison, veteran political strategist, contributing editor at The Root, and also Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start our calls with Lee in Milwaukee. Hi, Lee.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, yeah. I'm glad you all are having this discussion. I was telling the person on the phone that I'm from Milwaukee, and I was at a restaurant yesterday, and a couple of us were actually watching the debate while we were waiting to pick up our food, and a lot of folks were talking about how they support Sanders. And, you know, I think in the mainstream media and also with social media, you don't actually get a real view of black voters. And I think that even though it is the primary, I think that Sanders could have more of an appeal for black voters to turn out more so than Clinton. And I think the fact that he doesn't, I think, like, for me, when he says working class voters or working class people, that's something that the Democratic Party usually doesn't say. They usually talk about middle-class voters, and that usually is a default for white. And I think that, you know, I think Sanders, even though he doesn't always typically say, I'm talking to black voters, he definitely, I think, more so speaks on issues that impact our community and that people are responsible to outside of the kind of black political establishment, outside of going to sorority fraternity or churches or traditional areas that Clinton seems to target.
Mm-hmm. Charles, let's give that one to you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad your caller reflected on that. You know, and it's, you know, it Sanders does definitely have a lot of potential there with a lot of the language that he's employing and the recent pivot that he's taken in terms of, you know, once again, not using language about criminal justice and prison reform as a trigger to finally start talking about voters of color. You know, if he does kind of keep striking that chord about, you know, the working class, about black unemployment, underemployment, about schools, we have not even had a conversation yet, the presidential candidates on either side of the aisle, about K-12 education.
Mm-hmm.
We keep talking about, like, college tuition and student loans, but, you know, it makes no sense to talk about those items if, you know, kids can't even get to college because of a crumbling K-12 system. So, you know, but if he strikes those chords, he might see some lift in terms of his black numbers. I don't think that he's still going to get, by the time this primary is over, he'll get the majority of the black vote. I think that because of those built-in relationships that the Clintons have had for a very long time with the black political community, I'm not going to say establishment, it's more like a community, especially in places down south where you have, like, strong numbers, solid numbers of black voters, it's just not going to happen for Sanders. Another thing, too, is that, you know, Sanders just has a very slim, very thin civil rights policy record. So, yeah, he talks a lot about civil rights, but, you know, he doesn't have a deep archive of policy action. You know, it's not, he doesn't really, you know, submitted any or introduced or passed any major civil rights legislation. You know, it's, you have an archive, a robust archive, for better or for worse, good or bad, with the Clintons, at least, that you can kind of pull from, and you're like, okay, well, this is the devil I know as opposed to the devil I don't know. So Sanders is still a mystery on that level. And then, you know, he's a mystery in terms of his relationship with black constituents because he comes from a state where there's only 8,000 black people in it. And so it's like, you know, and also a place where, you know, about 11% of the state's prison population is black. So you have, if you're a black person living in Vermont, you're 11 times more likely to end up in jail than walking on a Burlington street. And so that's stuff that he has to address as he's being vetted by the black electorate, by black voters. But I do agree with the caller. I mean, there are some things where he's striking a certain chord and tone. He has pivoted, but it's just been recent, within the past few weeks. And so, you know, let's see how that turns out. That definitely will put a lot more pressure on Hillary Clinton to also kind of be a lot more aggressive in terms of her stance on certain policy issues that are of concern to the black electorate.
And let's take this just a little bit further, because I'm wondering I've been wondering about this relationship with the black community that the Clintons have. When you say that they have a deep archive, I mean, some of it is pretty negative, really. Welfare reform was negative. Certainly, the way they ran a campaign against Barack Obama did a lot of unhappiness in the black community. What is the deep archive, and does not Senator Sanders get some credit for the work that he did at the University of Chicago for his being at the March on Washington? I mean, he's got an archive. archive as well. Why is theirs stronger, do you say?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, too. Like, I was talking to Reverend Al Sharpton yesterday about that. And so, you know, he hasn't endorsed either candidate, but, you know, he made this very clear distinction between marching and between being active in the movement. And so when he talked about Bernie Sanders, he's like, okay, I appreciate Bernie Sanders marching, but was he really active in the movement? I'm not so sure. You know, other people were active in the movement. In terms of those relationships established with the black political community, even on those negative things like welfare reform or the omnibus crime bill, for example, let's talk about the 94 omnibus crime bill. That actually came to being as a result of those close relationships with the black political community on the state, local, and federal level. So that's at that time, that's what a lot of black politicians, actually a lot of folks in the black grassroots political community, what they wanted, because there was a lot of crime in their neighborhoods. It was a public safety and quality of life issue. And that's one of those narratives, that's one of those stories that's kind of left out. It's just sort of, oh, the Clintons at the time wanted to pass this crime bill. No, there was a lot of black people who were signing on to that. Same thing with, like, stand your ground laws, for example, in Florida. You know, black state legislators voted for, and in other states voted for stand your ground laws because they were, and understandably so, they're dealing with high crime in their neighborhoods, and they're raising families, they're raising communities, and they needed to find an end to the crime. So, you know, and then, and Bernie Sanders voting for that. So it's, there's a lot of context there that's sort of being left out. But also in terms of those relationships, in terms of the number of, you know, you had with the Clinton administration at the time, the highest proportion of active African Americans in terms of aides, in terms of cabinet secretaries, et cetera, who were, you know, in presidential history. So, and in high levels as well. So that's something that, and he also had a very good relationship with folks like the Congressional Black Caucus. So, you know, yeah, it did get very complex and complicated in the 2008 primary when Hillary Clinton was trying to win that first time. And so those tensions are still very raw, and that has influenced in a very negative way the Clinton black electorate relationship. And that's something that that's going to follow her into the general election. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have problems with black voters really not being mobilized by the Clintons like they used to.
And Jennifer, what about in the Latina community? Are there any presidential candidates now, and maybe we'll have to go to previous elections, where there is a natural affinity, where there is a deep archive, to be using that word again, that a candidate has had with that community?
You know, I actually do not think that there has been a case. I think that the Latinos, because overwhelmingly they have been a Democratic voting bloc, now they're not exclusively a Democratic voting bloc when you look at some other axes of divisions within the community, but I think that the Democrats have carried the Latinos for reasons of party affiliation and not necessarily for reasons of the kinds of relationships that Charles just highlighted that exist within the black community. I think the only real notable jump that we saw was in the re-election of Barack Obama and Barack Obama's support for deferred action for undocumented immigrants. I was just looking at a study this morning, really drove the Latino vote and was a high predictor of the Latino support for Obama in that moment. But that was very strategic, and that also came about because of the action of young undocumented youth who call themselves Dreamers, taking over campaign headquarters and really demanding attention from then incumbent Barack Obama on the issue. So I think the Democrats have really relied on party ideology to keep Latino voters in the fold and have not necessarily cultivated the kind of policy or activist or representational ties that we see in terms of the black community.
And I wanted to ask you about this report today that George Soros and others will be bankrolling a $15 million campaign to mobilize Latinos and other immigrants this fall, according to the New York Times, to channel outrage at the political rhetoric of Donald Trump and other Republicans into a surge of votes for Democratic candidates in November, which is what they hope to do. What do you think of that initiative? Is it large?
You know, it's actually the first I heard of it, so I just was looking at the article. I think it's important. I think voter turnout among Latinos is extremely low, particularly, as I said, among Latino millennials. And part of the idea is that when we look at the data on why Latino turnout is so low, we see that Latinos and other ethnic minority groups as well don't have a framework in which they see themselves as someone who votes, right? And so the idea is, are you the kind of person that can influence the political process? Are you the kind of person who can participate in the political process? So I think get out the vote drives that are going to work on sending that message, and perhaps Trump is the galvanizing way to frame that message, that you can turn out in opposition, be the person who votes to oppose someone else. I think that is extremely, extremely important. And we do see there have been reports about Latinos who are eligible for citizenship looking to accelerate the naturalization process in the next few months so that they can vote in the upcoming elections. And so I do think there will be a mobilizing effect. And I think particularly if it's targeted in states that both have high levels of Latino-eligible voters, so again, Florida, Colorado, Nevada, and states that are likely to be consequential in the election, those same states, I think that there can be a very large difference if those turnout registration drives are successful.
Mm. Lee, thanks so much for your call. You sparked a lot of interesting conversation. Ryan is next in Waukesha. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning, afternoon, and good, great discussion going on. I really appreciate this important issue. I think we're really in an era of some renewed civil rights going on. I mean, it's very obvious. It's a systematic approach to limit people's participation, and in a lot of the legislation that has occurred, for both from the standpoint of personal rights and also voting rights, those kinds of things, a tremendous concern because of the backslide. I think where we were, we're actually in a worse state than we were many years ago when during the Johnson administration, when most of the Great Society stuff came in. I guess what's happening, and my comment is that we seem to be in a tub of warming water, the proverbial frog, and discouraging minorities from becoming more involved because of some of the barriers that we're placing there, cultural barriers in the kinds of laws that we're passing, and then the actual limitations and intimidation that comes with that to get them out as participants in our democracy. So that's my observation and my concern, probably not so much of a question, but I'm feeling very, very impatient about having to make some progress and support the minority effort in terms of getting full participation instead of intimidating them and holding them back. So, I'm a white guy, but I'm very feeling a need to move ahead on civil rights issues.
Thank you, Ryan, so much. I'm sure you'll get an interesting response. Charles, starting with you.
Yeah, you know, it's some very interesting reflections from Ryan. And, you know, first, I think what you're seeing is, you know, not so much sort of this new civil rights movement, as some folks are calling it, but sort of a civil empowerment movement or civil empowerment moment. There's a lot of focus on, even with like Black Lives Matter or the police reform, police brutality debate, that's about empowerment. Or even with voter ID, voter suppression laws, that's about political empowerment. You know, suddenly, you know, there's this shift from focusing on, okay, you know, you guys, you need to make sure that, you know, just society as a whole just recognizes us and make sure we have access to various processes and various institutions. Now it's about, well, you know, about group empowerment. You know, now African Americans especially are like, we want real, true political empowerment where we can leverage these resources in a very meaningful way for our community. So, you know, it's gone from that discussion about, you know, hey, we're going to march on Washington and just, you know, pass some laws so we can desegregate schools and desegregate neighborhoods to, you know, well, I want a piece of the pie, too. I want some of that political and economic power. That's also created an issue whereby a lot of African Americans, particularly younger African Americans, feel very detached and jaded detached from and jaded about the political process and the way it operates and the way Washington works, the way their city halls work or their state legislatures. A lot of folks, I mean, and this is just across the board, all populations. I mean, we're in desperate need of a national civics lesson or re-engagement on civics. You know, people just don't understand how the political process works, and so they feel very detached and disassociated from it. They don't feel those processes or those machines are working for them because they don't know how to start, say, you know, a neighborhood in Baltimore that was impacted by unrest. They don't understand that maybe they should get together and create a political action committee, for example, and everybody puts in $5 in the pot. And then, you know, you start trying to influence politicians in City Hall in the Baltimore political machine. They don't understand how that works. And so, and the black political community has done a very poor job, generally speaking, of kind of, you know, navigating the rest of the community through that. So that creates some tensions and some struggles and some challenges there. That said, overall, I mean, let's still be clear. Black political participation, particularly, is still very high. Black political awareness is still very high compared to other demographic groups, and that's whites, Latinos, Asians, everyone. Black people, just generally speaking, because of the history, are just much more sensitive and much more aware of a lot of fluctuations and trends that are taking place economically and politically. So, you know, the stakes feel very high for us. And so we just happen to be, even, you know, the most casual political observer or the guy that's kind of, or you know, the woman who's sitting, you know, kind of at their kitchen table and they're just watching the TV casually and a news flash comes up, they're a little bit more perceptive or aware of those changes taking place because they know that somewhere down the line it's going to impact them in a much more disproportionate fashion. And so that, so you do see a lot more black political awareness and activity or participation compared to other groups.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ryan, for your interesting comments. And I do want to ask you, Jennifer, before we go back to phone calls at 800-486-8655, to dig a little deeper into some of these numbers. And let's go to the 2012 presidential election. These are interesting percentages. 64% of non-Hispanic white eligible voters cast ballots. 67% of black eligible voters, more than the white population. By comparison, the voter turnout rate, 48% among Hispanics. What do you make of those numbers? Why are they what they are?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think the question for Latinos, it really is actually about turnout. Because when we look at the proportion of Latinos who are eligible to vote, that would be Latinos who have citizenship status, who are not imprisoned, and who are of the right age, they're actually registered in very high numbers compared to their population. The loss really does seem to be in turnout, right? And so Latinos simply not going to the polls. And I think there are a lot of structural factors involved with that in terms of time to get to the polls, ability to get to the polls, transportation to the polls. You know, we vote on a Tuesday in the general election. That can be a difficult day for folks who juggle many work and family responsibilities to get to the polls. And so I think the question that the caller posed about, you know, the renewed civil rights question, the effort to depress turnout among minority voters, perhaps, I would guess, one common mechanism that's thought of are state laws surrounding voter identification needed to vote, mm-hmm. State laws surrounding early voting, mail-in voting. So if we actually think about turnout, there's an interesting debate about how Latinos are going to be affected by some of these state laws around voter ID and limits of early voting. What I see is that Latinos are not as harmed as other population groups by voter identification requirements, because if Latinos are eligible to vote, they're a population that in general wants to become documented, so they will have the documents that would allow them to obtain the requisite ID. But things like restrictions on early voting, restrictions on mail-in voting, those can be really pernicious for a population that is unlikely to turn out because it makes it more difficult to turn out in any other way but in person on a Tuesday. And I think the trends that I mentioned earlier about Latinos, again, speaking in very general terms, right, not seeing themselves as a group that's particularly mobilized or included in the political process, because other than immigration and other than immigration as a way to sort of offend and horrify and thus galvanize Latinos, you know, necessarily do not see the issues that they care about reflected in a really robust way from politicians.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, I have another question, but let's go back to phone calls. Thank you, Ryan, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we will take more of your phone calls momentarily. We're looking at 2016, the electorate being the most diverse in U.S. history, and what that means for various candidates and for political parties. There have been a lot of people active in the Republican Party who have said we really need to pay attention to this vote, particularly the Latino-Latina vote, because it's going to cost us the presidency, and it will for years to come. It may in 2016, almost certainly will in 2020, unless there is outreach made to the community. We're looking at the numbers of people who have been voting, the African-American vote, which was higher than the vote in 2012 among non-Hispanic white eligible voters. The lowest was Hispanic or Latino-Latina voters, and why that's the case. So we have a lot going on this hour. More phone calls momentarily. We can also have you give us your comments on email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always love to hear from you. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two guests with us this hour, Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics, Latin American and Latino-Latina Studies at Occidental College, Charles Ellison, veteran political strategist, contributing editor at The Root, and Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Josh in Madison, hello. Josh, yes, go ahead. General, you'll have to call us back, Josh. We got a bad phone connection. Judy in Eau Claire. Hi, Judy.
Oh, hi. I would just like to make the comment that it seems to me that Bernie Sanders' message regarding economic inequality would reach a lot of the black voters, and I don't know if it's name recognition that is why Hillary's getting votes, but to me it seems like Bernie would be a good choice.
Charles?
Yeah, you know, there's an infrastructure of name recognition for the Clinton machine. That's very obvious. I mean, there is this sort of assumption that voting for Hillary Clinton is akin to electing the third black president, because there was this joke, ongoing joke back in the Clinton years, that he was the true first black president. And then, obviously, Obama came along. It, you know, sort of changed that whole notion. But yeah, it's that, you know, a lot of this deals with name recognition. I mean, let's sort of, you know, keep it real. You know, presidential elections are beauty pageants. I mean, it's very cosmetic. It's all about optics. A lot of times it's not even about issues. It's about how voters perceive the candidates on some kind of personal level. And so that's something that's, you know, definitely kind of big on the minds of many black voters. Not all, you know, a lot of them are concerned about the issues. In fact, most are. So real quick, you know, one thing I do want to say, kind of going back to that last segment, is that, you know, we do have to also look at the, you know, as far as Republican Party outreach and what that's going to look like in the coming years. You know, there's some interesting trends that are taking place as far as, once again, black migrants are concerned, like folks from the Caribbean and Africa, and there might be some openings for Republicans in terms of some population shifts. You know, they're looking at those, you know, a little bit more conservative in terms of some issues on social and maybe even fiscal issues, voters who come from the Caribbean or from Africa, you know, may start taking a second look at Republican voters. So that's something that Democrats have to worry about. In the context of this 2016 election, Democrats are really going to have to find something that inspires those pockets of voters, like black voters, like Latino voters, rather than makes them afraid. So just fear of Donald Trump or fear of immigration or deportation, that's not enough. You know, these voters have to feel some sort of connection to the candidates, to the presumptive nominee. That's not there yet. And one last thought real quick, Kathleen, is that there is some chatter. I mean, I've talked off record with folks within the black political community for over a year now. And they're showing some concern for a lot of the Democratic brass's focus on Latino voter outreach. You know, they feel like, hey, well, you know what, we're always voting for you guys. We want a little bit of that of that juice as well, some of those resources you're trying to put into the Latino electorate, when we've proven ourselves cycle after cycle, time and time again. There is some tension between those two political communities. That's not talked about a lot, but it is there, like the Congressional Black Caucus feeling like the president meets more with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. You know, that kind of tension is kind of playing itself out here and there throughout this primary and throughout this election. Mm-hmm. I've been hearing it from a lot of folks over the past year.
Feel like you're being taken for granted?
Right. You know, they do feel like, you know, Democratic Party does take black votes for granted. They've been doing it for a number of years, a number of cycles. And then they suddenly feel like, oh, you know, new Latino vote comes along, and you guys are a lot more excited about that than you are about us. You know, we've proven our loyalty. And so there's some raw feelings there about that. I've talked to actually black elected officials on state, local, and even federal level off record who say this. So that's there, and it could have an impact on kind of how things shake out for the general election.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, the Republican candidates, maybe even some who have dropped out of the race, but it would be more interesting to find out if there are some now that Latina vote might most likely go for. Are there any?
You know, it's hard to say. I looked at the exit polls from Texas, and that was one of the few places where we did have an exit poll that actually looked at Latino and Latinos as a group. And of Latino voters, they were pretty much evenly split between Cruz and Trump and then Rubio. And so Carson and Kasich, I think at that point, were already on their way out. You know, I don't think, even though both Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio can position themselves as Latino leaders, as leaders with Latino identity, I don't think that that's a big enough draw. You know, I think Rubio's greatest weakness was that he pivoted on immigration reform. He was a member of the Gang of Eight in the Senate looking to work on comprehensive immigration reform. And when he decided to, you know, throw his electoral futures in with the Republican Party and abandon hopes for immigration reform, in order to sort of cultivate himself to the Republican base, I think that really hurt him, and I think he would have a hard road to claw back with Latino voters because of that. I think Ted Cruz is an interesting case. When we look at Latino voters and we look at Latinos and we start looking within them to see how they might vary and differ, one of the major trends in the Latino community is, of course, a greater shift towards Latinos, towards evangelical Protestantism and other forms of evangelical denominations, and then leaving the Catholic Church. So could Ted Cruz pick up on some Latinos who are going to identify with him on religious and moral grounds? I think that's possible, but we're still not sure how much Latino evangelical voters are mobilized as a voting group when compared to their white evangelical peers. And, you know, the Latino voters who supported Trump in that Texas exit poll, you know, I think that on one hand, I want to say you got me. I don't know. On the other hand, I might say that when we look at Latino voters, especially Latino voters who are third generation and up, English-dominant Latino voters, and higher-income Latino voters, they certainly behave a lot more like a traditional Republican voter, and that might explain the support for Trump. But is there any of those three candidates who I think that could unify Latinos and claim that they have Latinos as a voting block in their back pocket? I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you both have been great. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you'll join us again. We got many months ahead to dissect all that's going on. It's a year, isn't it? What a year this is.
It is, absolutely. I'd be more than happy to come back on. Thanks so much.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Great.
Thank you so
Thank
much. As
you.
I said, this year has thrown out some of the conventional wisdom, so we just have to keep doing our best to figure out what's going on.
Right. Yeah, it sure has. Out the window. Our thanks to Jennifer Piscopo, Assistant Professor of Politics, Latin America, and Latino-Latina Studies at Occidental College. Charles Ellison, a veteran political strategist, contributing editor at The Root, and Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Tribune.